Welcome to Everyday Martial Artist, a weekly podcast where you'll join me, Brian Doucette, as I interview a different martial artist each episode and hear their story. Some guests you may have heard of, and some you probably haven't. Be sure to subscribe where all your favorite podcasts are available. Also, visit our website at everydaymartialartist.com. If you're listening for a specific interview, I sure hope you'll stay and check out the other episodes. A very special thank you to Topher Williams for our custom theme music. And now, the newest episode of Everyday Martial Artist. Everyday Martial Artist is brought to you by KOOnline.com for all your martial arts needs. Sparring and safety gear, rank belts, uniforms, weapons, patches, and more. Wholesale supplies made by martial artists for martial artists. Visit us today at KO-Online.com. Hello and welcome to Everyday Martial Artist. I'm your host, Brian Doucette, and as we do every week, we're joined by a brand new guest talking about their life and their journey throughout the world of martial arts and other stuff they're involved in. My guest today has been involved in martial arts for almost 50 years. He's not only a 9-3 black belt, but a USA master boxer, a certified personal trainer, and an accomplished Rhode Island Hall of Fame inducted drummer who's the co-founder and co-chair of the Rhode Island Musicians Tune-In and Tune-Up Awareness Program. He currently runs a whole arts training center. He's also an inventor, owns a dog leash company, manages a tree farm, and is writing a book. Sounds like he likes to stay busy like me. Please welcome my guest today, Mr. Don Culp. How are you doing today, Don?
Doing very well, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for taking the time. I truly appreciate it. What we like to do with all my guests, I want to go back to the very beginning. I want to find out where that first spark came from, that first interest that kicked off your martial arts journey.
Well, that's interesting. I was living in New Hampshire at the time. I'm in Rhode Island now. This would have to be about probably 1971, 72, something like that. I came across somehow my first Bruce Lee movie. Nice. I don't know where I saw it, maybe clicking around on the channels. And that really sparked the interest. I had no instructor at that time. I just would go outside and throw kicks and punches and make crazy Bruce Lee sounds. But that really kind of got the fire going. And then when I moved to Rhode Island in 1976, I met my first karate instructor. And that's when the real journey started.
And what style was that in that you met him?
Well, he was a Kenpo practitioner, but also had a black belt in Taekwondo. So I kind of got influenced by both the kicking aspects of Taekwondo, but Kenpo was my main art, which was influenced by Professor Nick Sirio, who brought his version of Kenpo to Rhode Island. So that's the style that I studied for several years.
Okay, yeah, I've actually talked to a few people that have mentioned Nick. So yeah, he definitely had an influence out on the East Coast there. That's good.
He sure did. I got a lot of stories about him, and I studied, you know, through one of his black belts at first, and then I studied directly with him privately for a while. And he was a good friend and a great instructor.
So when you first started in that official class, what are some of the things that stand out? What do you think really drew you in and made you want to keep doing it?
Well, like I said, when I moved to Rhode Island, the true story is I met this girl. She was studying with this instructor, and she said, "You got to come down and check out a class," because I told her I loved karate. And he was teaching. He just started. So he was teaching at the Recreation Center in Jamestown, Rhode Island. And I remember walking into the gym for the first time, and there was a heavy bag hanging from one of the basketball nets. And that's kind of how we used to do our workouts.
Wow.
And we had some pads and a few things, but it was very bare bones. And this instructor's name was David Arundel. And I just really took a liking to him, not only from the physical aspect of what he was doing, but he also would give some Zen talks and talk about spirituality. And that really drew me in as well, which I'm really happy about, because that was a whole unknown area of martial arts for me. Of course, I was intrigued like everybody with the kicking and punching and the way Bruce Lee moved. But when I started to, even at an early age, get into the spiritual aspects, it helped answer some questions for me when I was growing up. So that really got me excited about the whole aspect of martial arts, the physical and the spiritual aspect.
And what do you mean by that? Helped answer some questions for you? What expand a little on that?
Well, I was adopted. I was in a few foster homes when I was younger, and then we moved 5 times before I was 16. So I was always being shuffled around, and so quite honestly, I was very insecure as a young boy. Struggled with I'd make friends, and then we'd have to move away, and so it was always difficult for me when we get into like I said, before I was 16, I lived in 5 different cities and was in 5 different schools. So I felt a little bit out of sorts a lot of times, like I didn't really fit in. And so when I found martial arts and the philosophy of it, it really helped tie in a lot of loose ends for me. And I jumped in with both feet. I trained 7 days a week.
Wow.
for a lot of years. Yeah, up until my black belt. Then I opened my own dojo. We can go in chronological order, but to answer that question more specifically, it really helped me get through some tough times because it gave me a belief system. And I also learned that the more I practiced, the better I got. And that made me feel good. So today, as you know, I'm 62 years old now. That was when I was 16. When I come across students who I tell are struggling as well, I can really recognize it because I had the same issues. Nice. So it really gives me a lot of joy to be able to use the martial arts to help these students find their way. And it's very successful. Okay. When you connect the two dots.
With the Kenpo and the Taekwondo background, I know a lot of people in those styles get heavily involved in tournaments and competition. Is that ever something you got into?
I did. I competed in my, I was a white belt, and like I said, I started in 76. I think my first tournament was 77. It was a Nick Serio tournament, interestingly enough. And we did it at the Knights of Columbus. I think it was in Warwick, Rhode Island. Nice. And it was an unbelievable experience. I remember I placed in forms, and then I won the first place in fighting.
Wow.
And it was really cool because I remember I had five fights. I was scared to death. But for some reason, I just completely let myself go, and I won every match 5-0. So I was just like on fire that day, except for the last match, which I had with one of our fellow students. Mike Jones was a great guy, big URI kid. A lot older than me and bigger, but we had a beautiful match. It was 4-4. And I remember he was driving me back, and I did a jump spinning sidekick in the air out of the ring, but scored the point before I landed outside. And I remember Professor Serio at the time said, "Is that the best you can do?" He was making a joke about it. The reason why I told you this story more specifically is because what happened to me when I started going to tournaments after that, I thought the same thing was going to happen. And I was thinking too much. And it took me quite a few years to realize why I did so well in that first tournament was because I was nervous and scared. And I just said, "All right, let's just go for it." And I didn't get in my way. I just let my techniques flow. And then when I fought in tournaments after that, I was thinking too much and I was sabotaging my own movement and hesitating. So that was a good kind of comparison lesson for me there. I did quite a few tournaments. I won a few grand championships. When tournaments started to get with more professional teams and they mm-hmm. really grew, I'm not saying that I didn't like that, but it wasn't really my thing, you know? Yeah. And it became more of a game of tag. When I first started in that tournament in 77, we wore cups and mouthpieces. That was it. You know, no hand gear, no foot gear, no mm-hmm. head gear. And it was controlled, of course, but we went hard to the body. And there was contact to the face, but not as much as you'd think because the black belts were really on top of you and, you know, integrity and, you know, respect were very, very much emphasized. And in all honesty, I've noticed when tournaments started to grow and professional teams, I said, started happening, it became a little bit more political and kind of became a game of tag on some levels. And some mm-hmm. people got great at that. Like they got great at that particular style of fighting. But I kind of wanted to go in a different direction. So I started boxing because I wanted something a little more real.
Okay.
I noticed when in a lot of tournaments, when you'd clash with somebody, that person would fall down and then the referee would say stop and then you'd regroup. And I said, man, that's not really a smart way to fight, mm-hmm. to fall down every time or commit so much to a technique that you're exposing yourself. So I wanted to get into something a little more real. But I probably did about, 20 good years of tournaments.
Wow.
And a lot of great memories, but I just kind of steered into a different direction after that.
Did you ever go out and compete in the internationals in Long Beach?
No, I never went that far. I did all the local tournaments and there were some big ones around here. And then I did a tournament in Ohio.
Nice.
They called it a world gathering. It was for Black Belt Hall of Fame and they had a nice tournament. And I actually won that tournament. That was pretty cool. But like I said, when it started to get to where the international tournaments and the big, big competitions kind of wasn't my thing. So I went in a little bit of a different direction.
Okay. And then when you started doing boxing, did you keep doing the martial arts at the same time or did you take a short break or?
Well, what happened was I was sparring with a professional kickboxer and I was a pretty good point fighter because I had good range and I could keep guys away with my back fist, but he's kept getting inside of me and he was beating me up. My nose was bleeding. I remember I threw him against the wall. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm boxing." I'm like, damn, I got to learn some of this because I wasn't a very accomplished inside fighter because I was into tournaments. Again, that's one of the reasons why I knew I needed to expand my game. So I searched out a boxing coach, happened to be a boxing coach at a health club I was teaching karate at. I asked him if he were to give me a hand. He came down and had me hit the bag a little bit. And turned out his name was Don Rathburn. He was a fantastic guy. He's passed away now, but he fought pro on some of the undercards of Rocky Marciano fights.
Wow.
So he had some cool stories. But he said, yeah, you got a little work to do. But he started training me. And then I hope we're not jumping too far ahead. All right?
No, that's fine.
He started training me and he started taking me to gyms around Rhode Island, around Providence and Warwick. And there's some good gyms around here, some good gritty fighters. And I started sparring with some big heavyweights, some guys that were pro fighters. And again, that was nerve wracking, but I overcame that. And then I did a couple of fights with him too. So it was a pretty cool experience. But I consider it to be a part of my martial arts because I knew that I needed to get away from the point tournaments and get into something that was, you know, a little different. And so that expansion was very important for me. And I've since been studying jiu-jitsu, obviously, and I've studied directly or indirectly a lot of different styles and tried to draw from them what I think is the most suitable techniques, very much like what Bruce Lee did with Jeet Kune Do.
Right.
And that was a big influence on me. But that's kind of the history of my tournaments from, nice. We did a lot of sparring and I sparred with a bunch of guys who were on like the John Paul Mitchell team. And,
okay.
You know, so I had some, you know, some, I tasted that competition, but like I said, I just wanted to get in something that I thought was a little more realistic and that I needed to improve upon. So that's why I went in that direction.
So then it sounds like then boxing kind of launched that part of your life where you wanted to, I don't know if maybe at that time you didn't really think of creating your own style or your own system, but you definitely knew you needed more than what you had
and
started looking for other stuff. So then what, after boxing, what was the next style you did you specifically seek out another style or did you stumble upon something? How did the next style come about?
Well, I studied some Ed Parker's Kempo, which was different than the Nick Serio style Kempo. Yep. And then I was studying indirectly, when I say indirectly, through videos and books and seminars. I started doing some capoeira, nice. some Eskrima, and, you know, different styles like that. Muay Thai, just kind of picking up the philosophies. Jiu-jitsu, for sure. But a big breakthrough for me was when I met a gentleman named Sensei Walter von Krenner, who is out of Kalispell, Montana. And he's an unbelievable martial artist. He was a judo champion in Germany in 1961, the year I was born, ironically. And he's a very interesting story. When O Sensei, the founder of Aikido, his son, I believe it's Kisamura. I'm not quite 100% sure how to pronounce his name. So, but he was doing some demonstrations of Aikido. He happened to come to Hawaii, where Sensei von Krenner was living and teaching at the time, judo, and he was knocked out by Aikido. So he's went to Japan and studied Aikido with O Sensei before he passed away. Wow. And actually, Sensei von Krenner's published quite a few books. One is called Training with the Master, which is amazing. He took all these photographs of O Sensei. So that would have been 1969, I think, because I think O Sensei died in 69. So he studied with them for a year. But so Walter von Krenner became a very proficient Aikido practitioner, and he's a calligraphy artist and just an incredible martial artist, practicing Buddhist and Zen philosopher. But how I connected with him was I was brought to Montana to do some seminars at a Kempo school. And the teacher there said, you got to check out this guy who's in Kalispell now. And so I went to one of his classes and was knocked out. And he took a liking to me, invited me to his house the next day, had a beautiful ranch at the base of the Rocky Mountains in Kalispell.
Wow.
And I did the traditional thing. I asked his permission to, if he would accept me as a student. And he was knocked out by that and said, absolutely. So, of course, we're many, many hundreds of thousand miles away. But I flew out to Montana several times and stayed at his guest house and studied Aikido with him. But I was really interested in the philosophy as much as the Aikido. But that kind of gave me another little twist on what I was doing as far as blending more and angle shifting. Because mm-hmm. a lot of Aikido is based on dealing with the sword. So you need to obviously learn to shift and cut angles. And that was a big part of what eventually evolved into my own system. And Sensei von Krenner helped me define a name for my system. And he gave me the confidence. He said, you know, he calls me DC. He goes, you know, DC, you have a very unique thing happening here and you should really consider putting your own system together. And I'm like, I didn't believe that I could do that. But again, he gave me the confidence and we came up with a name, which is called Shizendo, which means the natural way. But we derived of that name by over breakfast I stayed for a whole week several times, but this particular time, we were eating breakfast and he said, what would you like your style to represent? And I, you know, gave me a couple of days to think about it, but I love nature. I love animals and obviously the planet and being outside. And I get such a good vibe from being outside. So he said, I'd like it to represent nature in some way. So we started looking through different books that he had and we came up with Shizendo, which is the natural way or with nature or spontaneous. It means several different things, but mm-hmm. So that's how the system that I have now kind of evolved. But it was through tournaments, through boxing, through many different styles, getting tastes of different styles, absorbing what is useful as a Bruce Lee quote. And then finally meeting Sensei Von Krenner, who really encouraged me and gave me the confidence to do my own thing, because that was ultimately where I needed to go. I loved a lot of all the instructors I had were big influences on me. But I knew even at a young age that I needed to go in my own direction, because I love to create things. And that caused some problems in some dojos. If you learn a technique from an instructor and maybe they've been doing that same technique for a long time, and then you say, you know, I think I found a better way to do this takedown or a better way to do this attack, sometimes it's not very well received.
Yep.
So I didn't want to be stymied. I didn't want to be disrespectful. So I realized that I had to go on in my own direction. And that's what I did probably about 25 years ago.
Okay.
And that's what I've been doing since then.
At what style, what age, what belt level did teaching become something that interested you?
Well, I started right when I made my black belt. I was teaching at Sifu Arundel School, and I was teaching classes for him. And then I started my own class. I think I had a Saturday afternoon class. And then we had a dojo in Bonnet Shores that he moved from to Wakefield, Rhode Island. Of course, I moved with him and we were teaching there. But then the old dojo came available. Somebody rented it and then it came available. And he told me that. I said, man, I'd like to open it. So he kind of helped me and we did it together. And I got the dojo going and then took it over full time. That was 1981. I think I made my black belt in 79, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I made my black belt pretty quick because I seriously was training 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, that's how that works. I opened a dojo in 81 and haven't looked back, been in several different locations, but I have a beautiful facility now here in North Kingstown. And that's how it all happened.
So you mentioned your black belt test. Talk a little bit about that first black belt test and then kind of compare it to the black belt test you give your students now.
Yeah, well, it was old school, you know, and we were kind of influenced by Professor Cirio. So you went through we did all your basics, you know, you got a good sweat on, and then you run your techniques. I did it with another student named Brian Delman. We were training simultaneously. So that was really cool because we went from white belt to black belt together. And I always tell my students, if you can hook up with someone and, you know, get a good partner and train with them, it really does help. Because Brian and I trained really heavy for a long time to prepare for our black belts. And I remember we had a very prestigious board of some high-level black belts from this area. And it's a long time ago now. So that was 70s, like I said, probably 77. But I remember it being very, very physically demanding and, you know, probably 3 hours nonstop. And but got through it and then went on. And every belt I've made since then, from first all the way to ninth, has been a physical test. I know you get to a point at sometimes where people honor you rank or whatever, but I've never really been into that. So I've had physical tests. My ninth degree was probably about 2 years ago now. So been physical tests all the way through.
So then with it being your own system now that you teach, who was overseeing your ninth degree test?
Well, I have an instructor who's actually a Nick Cirio black belt named Soki Jean Kutu. And he's got some great stories to tell too. And I look up to him a lot. He's a 10th degree. So probably around 5th degree, I started studying with him. And I tested for maybe 6th under him doing his system. But then I had a long talk with him and he was so cool because a lot of instructors wouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. I said, Soki, I want to really start my own system and I've got a lot of ideas and I'm not really sure where it's going to take me, but I just need to follow this path. But I still would like somebody to oversee me and guide me, but give me that luxury of either failing or succeeding. And he said, absolutely. He said, put your next test together and I'll come to your dojo with a couple black belts and we'll see what you got. And that's what he's done for my 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th degree. So I just call him up. I say, I think I'm ready. And he says, okay, put a test together. And he's got a great reputation. He's a very solid martial artist. So it's not like he's testing me in my own system, but he certainly knows the difference between good and bad technique.
Right.
So, and every time I test, he's looking for evolution, you know, me taking things and expanding upon them. And that's what he said that I've been doing. So that's why he's honored me with this rank. Yeah, that's the way it's been working since then. And I'd like to go for 10th degree, having my own system. You know, I could be the 10th degree of my system.
Right.
So that's something I've got kind of in the back of my mind. So that'll probably happen at some point, I'm sure, as well.
Okay. And then, so what about when your students test for black belt? What are their tests like compared to your original one?
Well, that's a good question. I've had a change with the times. You know, it's not that I don't put them through a good hard test, but times have changed. Even people's time restraints, you know, sometimes to do a 3-hour test on a Sunday afternoon like we used to, you know, they're just not as available. So I have cut back a little, actually quite a lot on a lot of the pre-arranged material. And I'll explain why. My feeling is that we are trying to develop ourselves, obviously, in a lot of areas, but certainly spontaneous self-defense is one of them. And we have a tendency as martial artists, I believe, to do a lot of pre-arranged practice. And we get really good at these pre-arranged techniques. So the uki falls a certain way, we move a certain way, and it kind of all fits nicely together. And the more you practice that routine, the better it gets. But the problem is, in my opinion, that's a routine. And what I want to really work on is being spontaneous, which is kind of the premise of Shizendo, the natural way. And so what I do with my students is we certainly cover all the gamut of jujitsu, knife, stick, and gun techniques, empty hand techniques, kumite, the kata, the whole thing, weapons. But we do little segments of each aspect of that. And then I do little pretests during class. When they have a technique ready, they'll demonstrate it for myself and the other black belts. If we accept it, we check it off and we move on. So we get through all their material that way. Then when it comes time to test, we take a handful of techniques from different categories. And they have to obviously perform those. But a big part of Shizendo testing is improvisation. So probably the second half of the test will be random attacks, one attacker, two attackers, three attackers, kicking, punching, grabs, weapons involved. So to see how the students can string together their movements. So that's a big, big part of our training. So I don't want to clutter that up with having to learn 100 empty hand techniques and you kind of become more of a memorization. I know when I studied Ed Parker's Kempo, which is an awesome style, but man, those techniques, there's like some of them have like 20 moves to each technique, you know? Yep. And I was forever trying to remember it. And I started to kind of get in my own way of moving by trying to remember what the move was. And of course, the more you practice it, obviously it comes out more fluid, but I wanted to work on having things just come out without having to think too much about them. And that's kind of, so I do a lot of drills. We certainly have, like I said, many prearranged techniques. Everything is videotaped and completely organized. So we teach it very consistently, but we do a lot of drills. I make up a lot of drills that correspond with the way I want students to move. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. And that's what they test, how their tests go.
Okay, nice. So think back to that very first Saturday class you used to teach to now. What do you think has changed about your teaching style over the years?
Well, probably the thing that we just discussed. Instead of teaching all these prearranged techniques, we certainly do some of that, but we do a lot more of drilling and to work on that spontaneous aspect. And I'll be honest, you know, I kind of wore my body out through a lot of the old hardcore training. I was very, very disciplined with Mukko Hour and stretching and kicking the pads and, you know, so I unfortunately had to have hip surgery. So a big part of what I do now is trying to get people, and again, that corresponds with the natural way of Shizendo. We're not doing a lot of that hardcore stuff. I don't feel the need to throw, 100 roundhouse kicks every night as hard as you can, because I just don't want to do that. And it would be very difficult for me to do it. So I think what I've done is tried to cut back on a lot of the more linear type training, the more pounding, and get more smooth, more fluidity, which obviously equals tremendous power because you, in my opinion, get more power from fluidity than you just do hard style, you know? So I think that the change mainly has been to more of a softer approach, yet still very firm. And that's what I call it. I call it a relaxed firmness, where you're very relaxed, but it's very firm. And you look for that pinpoint contact, and then you're released again so you can move subtly and move smoothly. So I think probably got away from a lot of the traditional hardcore training that I did for so many years. Now it's a lot more fluid and smooth. It's actually a little more enjoyable on many levels. And I find it to be very, very practical. So I have a philosophy that I say we counter movement with movement. So if somebody moves, you immediately move. It's not always going to be a block. It's not always going to be a strike, but just counter movement with movement. And that's a really important drill to practice. Just have someone step in at you and just see which way you move naturally without knowing what's coming. And then from there, you can build like, okay, maybe I'll strike. Maybe I'll have to block again. Maybe I can split. You know, I can get away from this person. So it's kind of led me into this area where, again, it's more spontaneous and working off of people's movement and how you move. So it's open. You know, it's not so tidy like it used to be. You know, I have a philosophy that a lot of karate, the way we train horse stances and punching from elbow position, was when you have like a big class of people, everybody kind of moving the same way. If you remember the Bruce Lee Enter the Dragon, when they had the scene where all the martial artists are working out, you hear the kiyas and you see everybody punching exactly in sequence. You know, I think that's really awesome. But I think that, you know, sometimes it's more of a group way of training than more of an individual way of training. And what I'd like to think is Shizen Do's become more of an individualized art where each student is certainly following my guidelines and following my instruction. But ultimately, I want them to find their own Do, their own way, because that's what's going to help them survive. Not doing techniques that I'm just, no, you got to kick higher, you got to do this, you got to angle this way. If that doesn't feel right for them, then that's not going to come out of them. And it might have them stumble in a real life situation. So I'm trying to help students discover their own natural way of moving, combined with the discipline of the techniques that we practice. So kind of putting that yin yang together.
That is so cool. Nice.
Thank you.
How many students have you brought to black belt under Shizen Do?
Not a lot. I mean, I've only awarded, I think, 21 black belts since I started training and started teaching. Yeah, but, you know, a lot of schools, unfortunately, today they have a lot of black belts. You know, I know there's black belt clubs and all that stuff. Yeah. I am still very traditional in that aspect. I feel they need at least 4 years of serious training before I even consider testing for black belt. So that is one traditional aspect that I'm still holding on to with both hands. I don't award junior black belts. You know, if you're ready to test for a black belt, no matter what your age, you'll test. But usually it's teenagers and above, because, you know, I just think that the younger students need more work, obviously developing themselves and their bodies. But that aspect is still in place. So black belts here are, you know, have to put in at least 4 good solid years of training before I even consider them for a black belt.
And what is the youngest you'll teach?
I have 7-year-old students.
Okay.
Yeah, 7. That's usually where I find, I mean, I know a lot of schools take them a lot younger, but I found personally over, and I've been teaching, like you said, well, for 45 years in the martial arts for almost 50 now. But sometimes when you bring them in too young, at first they're excited about it because they saw it on a cartoon or something. But in a real dojo, you know, they're not running around playing games and coloring in a coloring book. They're learning martial arts. So it turns some of the little kids off. And I've noticed over the years that some students have come to me and said, you know, I started karate when I was 4 or 5 and I got really turned off by it. So they won't continue to train when they get older because they had a bad experience. So I personally think that you should start them when they're a little more developed mentally and physically. It's just my philosophy. I know there's great black belts or great students at 4 and 5 years old. I get that. And I think my youngest was 4, actually, and he went on to make a black belt. So
nice.
I might seem like I'm contradicting myself, but that's an exception to the rule. Most of the students I find have the mental capacity at about 7, and then they get a good experience, and you can teach them a little more mature, you know, not just have them running around. And because I don't do, like, you know, the little dragons and things like that. I teach basically the same material all the way through, a little less of it for the younger kids, but they're learning the same punches, same kicks, same techniques as the teenagers and the adults.
And do your students do competitions, or are you more strongly focused on just pure self-defense?
Not as many competitions as we used to, not karate tournaments, but boxing. Yes, I actually had a student compete just a few weeks ago, had his first boxing match. He did phenomenal. Yeah, so we have a couple of organizations around here. One that's starting to develop that I'm excited about. It's going to be an amateur fight league that a friend of mine, Ed Cattucci, is starting, who's a really cool promoter, martial artist. And but he wants to go old school. You know, he wants there to be etiquette with the coaches, with the fighters. Safety is a really big and priority. If somebody gets stung, we're going to stop the match. And if they, you know, make a determination, probably stop it after that. But giving people a chance to get some real taste of competition, but without getting injured, you know, and having it be a good experience, you know, that's the biggest thing you want, is you want to have a good contest. Win or lose, you go in there, you fight your heart out, stay within the rules. The other guy does the same thing, or girl. At the end of the day, you both feel like you accomplished something. And that's what I think is very important about proper competition.
Nice. And now, in the intro, I mentioned you're currently writing your first book. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it would be a whole nother interview, but it has a great deal to do with what I was talking about earlier, some of the struggles that I had to deal with, you know, being adopted and then moving so much. The book is kind of, the main premise is about looking back so we can look forward. In other words, a lot of our hangups, a lot of our tendencies are a direct result of things that have happened to us in the past. Some we know, some we don't remember, but it all kind of gels together and develops our character. So if somebody's having difficulty with maybe being depressed or maybe anger or, you know, having trouble, you know, being disciplined, sometimes you can look back at things that happened in your past and you can kind of get an answer why. And so that helps you excel into the future by learning a little more about your past. But the other aspect of the book is looking at other people's past. For example, my father and I never really saw eye to eye for a little bit of period of our lives. And it was my fault because I was young and brash and didn't understand, you know, where he was coming from. But when I started to look back at his past, I realized that his father passed away when he was only 14 years old. So my father's father died. My father had to become the man of the house at 14 years old. Wow. And he was, you know, he was in the Navy on an aircraft carrier. He was an air traffic controller. That's why we moved so much, because he was trying to better his career to help his family. So he eventually retired as a chief air traffic controller for the FAA here in Rhode Island. But he was a very disciplined man, very stern, not real touchy-feely, you know, and I kind of was always, you know, hurt by that, you know, and I was angry about that when I was younger. But then when I started to research my father's life and realize what he went through and what he had to do to survive and to provide for his family, it started to make me realize, you know, more about him and just love him even more and respect him even more. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to write a book that would help people perhaps look at other people's lives a little bit more differently. You know, sometimes people make fun of somebody or bully somebody or say somebody's egotistical. Yeah. And that might be so. But if you took an opportunity and looked at where they came from and what they've had to endure, you know, I tell my students, you could stop 10 out of 10 cars as they drive by our dojo and ask the passengers if there's something wrong in their life. And every one of them is going to have a story. Yeah. Everybody is struggling in some degree. And so by understanding people past a little bit more, I believe it helps with relationships and even understanding yourself. So that's part of where the book is coming from. But it's also going to be about martial arts, about my musical career, you know, about inventing things, just, you know, a lot of different aspects of my life and trying to tie in, like if I was struggling with something, how I was able to get through that, which often was meditation, Zen Buddhist philosophies, you know, trying to better myself mentally, not just physically, but mentally. And so I talk about some of the trials and tribulations I went through, but how I survived. It's not a poor me book at all. It's this is what I went through. Everybody's had a story. Mine's no different than anybody else's in a lot of ways, but this is what I did to get to the point I'm at in my life now. And so hopefully it'll be a motivation for people.
That is cool. When do you hoping to have that out?
Well, it's a slow process, man, because I am busy and I write a chapter, then I go back and like, oh damn, I have to edit this. You know what that's like editing when you do your shows. So I can say that better, you know, and I go back and then, so right now I'm hoping sometime by the end of the year. I have an editor and someone who's going to publish it. That's kind of what helped spark this.
Yep.
A local teacher said that I should probably write a book. So that's what kind of motivated it. So I have some help there. But I guess when it comes out, it'll come out.
Okay. Well, you have to keep me updated. It definitely sounds like an interesting read. So.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you.
You talked about, obviously, you do boxing and you talked about sparring a kickboxer and stuff. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on something like MMA and the UFC? Is that something you're a fan of?
I am. You know, when the first UFC hit the cable, I think was maybe 1991.
93, December 93. Oh,
okay. Thank you, man. Thank you. Yep. It wasn't too far off. So I paid $9.99 for that and watched it. And it was like on a Saturday night, I think. And I went to class on Monday and we had a hardwood floor. So it's traditional dojo. Mm-hmm. But I said to my students, I have seen the future of martial arts. I knew right away, man, that this is something I needed to try to understand. And we started grappling right away on the hardwood floor. Nice. I've since, of course, graduated to a full padded dojo, but I really dug it. I liked it because I thought, once again, as I was explaining earlier, I thought a lot of the techniques that I was learning and that people were really grabbing onto, you know, spinning kicks and fancy arm bars and stuff, I just didn't think it would be effective in a real street fight. And then I started seeing what was working and what wasn't working. I remember that one gentleman who was a boxer and a great boxer, but he put a boxing glove on one hand. Yeah. He figured he was going to jab people away and then be able to grapple with the other hand. And that didn't last too long, you know. And there was, you know, some Taekwondo guys and wrestlers, and they're all great at their art. But the guys that were really doing well, obviously the jiu-jitsu guys hoisted, you know, really, really taught a lot of people about the importance of jiu-jitsu. But even using distancing and faking and feinting to shoot in to get his takedowns, all that stuff was really, really cool. And I knew that was going to be important to to understand. So I followed MMA for quite a while and still do. But I got to be honest with you, and I think as a ninth degree and a 50-year practitioner, I have the right to be opinionated. I'm not really crazy about the showmanship of it and even the violence of it. Sometimes I get a little turned off by it. It's just because as a 62-year-old martial artist with aches and pains and hip replacement, I know that way some of these people are training and competing, the human body is not really designed for that. And I understand why they do it, and I admire it, and I have great respect for those athletes. But when you get older, that takes a toll on your body. So I kind of try to educate people on just being very careful if they're going to pursue that. But I also, as a traditionalist, some of the etiquette, you know, a lot of the vulgarity and making fun of people. And, you know, I heard recently someone was making fun of someone's father who passed away or some stuff like that. It just crosses the line for me, you know. So that turns me off, to be honest with you. I like a good, pure, fair contest. You know, and if they want to do it with MMA rules, which pretty much is no rules, then that's fine with me, as long as they stay within the realm of competition. But the extracurricular stuff, I understand why they do it. That's why the UFC is worth, what, you know, $7 billion now.
Yeah.
So it sells tickets and puts butts in seats. I get that. But I like to look to the technique more than the extra jive that's surrounding it now, you know?
I agree. I used to watch it all the time. I used to never miss it. But in my opinion, the showmanship kind of turned into the WWE, which I was never a fan of.
Right.
It's just...
And as a side note, man, you know, it's affected my business. You know, it's affected a traditional karate school. Right now, I'm the biggest probably money maker, for lack of a better term, is boxing in my school. But I still use that format to teach etiquette and philosophy. So the students, and because I have a lot of teenagers come in, and most of them come in with the same intention. Like, I want to punch somebody in the face. And I go, that's wonderful. I said, have you ever been punched in the face? And they kind of look at me. If their father's standing next to them, I say, if your father gives me permission, I'll be happy to punch you in the face so you can see what it feels like. And they're like, oh, no, I don't want that. They just want to punch people in the face. So once I get past that, and I tell them that I don't teach violence, I teach art. And if we get past that little lecture, then I got them. And I teach them how to box. And we have a really cool system, which is, again, based on Shizen Do, a lot of movement and kind of a stick and move style. I really like Custom Models approach to boxing. So I studied his philosophies. Nice. But I also use it as a format to teach these kids about camaraderie and etiquette and respect and humility. Because a lot of tough guys come in and then they leave humbled. Because I still spar with them myself. So nice. I can kind of teach them real quick, you know, that they're not as tough as they think they are without hurting anybody. What I try to do is I just try to outbox them. Okay. I make them miss. You know, I touch them, I move away. I do that to try to just make them realize that maybe there's more to this than just swinging for the fences and you know, talking tough. There's more to it. And when they start getting into breathing and relaxing and centering their mind and controlling their emotions and realizing that that helps them be better boxers, then you're kind of shaping not only their boxing, but you're also shaping them as young men and women. I have obviously women students and girl students, but kind of shaping their lives a little bit through the discipline of boxing. So it's not just hardcore crash, bang, boom. It's good hard sparring, but good technique, good philosophy. And, you know, so that's kind of where I'm at with that.
Nice. You've mentioned philosophy a few times. So I'm curious, in all your years in the martial arts, is there one philosophy you've learned that is at the top of your list?
Well, certainly Zen, you know, the philosophies of Zen. And then Sensei Von Kren has taught me about Buddhism and you know, the concept there about, but it's not obviously a religion. It's just a way. You know, Sensei Von Kren taught me the true meaning of Do. You know, obviously we have Taekwondo, Judo, Aikido, Shizen Do, my system. And Do obviously means way. Mm-hmm. So a martial arts style is not just punching and kicking. There's a philosophy behind it, which is unique to not even every style, but even every dojo. At least it should be. The instructor should impart his philosophy or her philosophy, not just the physical techniques, but the spiritual techniques. But for me, it's just kind of a combination. And I'll tell you another interesting story. I was reading some Bruce Lee books. And of course, the first books I read were his self-defense methods and a lot of, you know, philosophy on self-defense. But when I started getting into like the Tao of Jeet Kune Do and some of his other writings, I started realizing he had a very spiritual side to him, a very deep side to him. I know that he studied philosophy, but I also know from having spent hundreds of thousands of hours on the mat myself that a lot of Bruce Lee's philosophies, spiritual philosophies, came from training, because I could see the definite connection there by having trained myself so much. In other words, trying to problem solve, you know, how to spin smoother, or how to shift smoother, how to block smoother, and realizing that, yeah, it's a physical connection, but there's a mental connection here as well. Breathing, relaxing, positioning your mind properly. And so that started to kind of open me up to a philosophy that was not really written in a book. It was more of a feeling that I was starting to get, how to connect the mental and the physical. And that, in the middle of that, was this philosophy. The next challenge I had, Brian, was how to teach that, because it wasn't something that I could necessarily just explain to them. They had to feel it. And that's where I started coming up with all these drills I talk about. So they don't have to worry about it full on technique. They can get this, like a flow drill back and forth. Once they get the physical aspects, then they can start tapping into the breath and then where to position their mind. You know, there's a couple beautiful sayings. You know, one is, when the mind is nowhere, it is everywhere. And if it has to go into your left hand, it goes into your left hand naturally. And it recognizes your left hand's purpose. If it needs to block or strike or catch or whatever, if your mind is nowhere, when you have to move your right foot, it goes into your right foot and recognizes that foot's purpose. And that's a beautiful philosophy that's called Mushin, which means mind of no mind. The samurai were very famous for that. And there's a wonderful book called The Unfettered Mind by Takim Soho, who was a sword master, but also a Zen master, who wrote a series of essays for the samurai. And I got turned onto that book by the Aikido community. That's a big book in the Aikido community. And that really started to make me think more about connecting the physical and mental. And then what came out of that is this philosophy that I've developed. And you know, I write a lot of quotes down and teach it within the realm of drilling. But that's kind of where it came from. And I'm proud of that, because I don't want to study somebody else's philosophy. Right. I can use their philosophy to enhance what I do. But that's one thing that I had to get the courage many years ago when I kind of went on my own, was kind of have belief in what I do. And then if somebody wants to listen to it, great. If they don't, that's fine too. But maybe I can expand onto them that they can come up with their own philosophies. I think too many martial artists study a fixed way and they get kind of stuck in that way. And that starts right at the top. If an instructor is just doing the same techniques over and over again, which is cool. And I get that, you know, it's a system, but to be limited to that same system, doing the same things over and over again, to me is not true art. True art is developing and expanding upon, you know, otherwise we'd still be lighting our dojo with kerosene lamps, you know?
Yeah.
So expansion is very important, and physical expansion, obviously, but mental expansion. I think the two have to grow simultaneously. I've known a lot of guys who were great fighters, man, could kick the bag up to the ceiling. But then when their bodies started to fail them as they get older, a lot of them struggled. And these are people that I knew who I really respected and still respect, but they never really dwelled into the mental aspect as deeply as they probably should have. Because when their physical being, they weren't the toughest guy at the cookout anymore, which is happens to us all, you know, but they were, a lot of these guys were kind of broken down. They didn't really have, you know, a lot of mental understanding to help get them to the next stage of their life. And so consequently, a lot of people got into drinking and going down a bad path. And so I really think it's important to keep the mental and physical moving together and expanding on techniques, creating, developing, being humble enough to say, there's a better way to do this. Even though I've been doing this for 20 years, there's a better way now. That's when I saw that first UFC, I said, that's a good way. that's a good thing to know, you know, and you got to be humble. Because I remember when UFC first came out and Hoist was taking everybody down, a lot of people were still saying, he won't take me down, you know, I'll hit him with an uppercut, or I'll knee him in the face, or, you know, I'll defend that, you know. But not many people could, especially in the beginning, you know. And then people figured out. Then people said, okay, they figured out how to deal with someone shooting in for a single or a double, or how to deal on the ground. So it was great for martial arts. It expanded people. And I hope it expanded them mentally as well as physically. That would be my one wish as a black belt.
Nice. I love your outlook. It's so cool.
All right. Thanks, man.
So I have some fun questions to wrap up the interview. Now, this one doesn't have to be four. It can be, I've had as few as two and as many as eight. So it's kind of up to you, but just 3, 4, 5 names you would put on your personal Mount Rushmore of martial arts.
Oh, wow. Well, certainly Bruce Lee would be probably first. I think Ed Parker would be second. I think Nick Sirio, definitely. And for me, Sensei Von Krenner, Walter Von Krenner, would have to be up there. Boy, that's a good one. And, you know, I think Takim Soho or even Gichin Funakoshi, who I never obviously trained with, but people that I've read and have been so influenced by their way. That would probably, but there's a lot of them, you know, but those are the ones that come to mind, you know, those are the ones that come to mind.
Okay, cool. All right. Do you have a favorite martial arts book?
Yeah, it would probably be The Unfettered Mind, I think.
Cool.
Would be a big read. And The Book of Five Rings, of course, I really dig. Although it's hard to understand, I read it a bunch of times, but I get something new out of it every time, which is what makes for a great read. But I think The Unfettered Mind is probably one of my top books, because it talks about the philosophy of Mushin, you know, mind and body acting is one, in a lot of different ways. And what I really took out of that just quickly was when Master Soho would talk about, you know, if you meditate, but you're focusing on something, you're really at beginner's mind. You might think you're at a high level. Like sometimes people say to me, I meditate every day for a half hour. I'm like, wow, a half hour. You time it? Yeah, I time it. Put the timer on. And I say, what do you meditate on? They say, well, I have a little statue of Buddha that I stare at for a half hour. And I'm like, well, that's cool. But I'm like, that's not really meditating, because you're forcing yourself a half hour and forcing yourself to focus on something. And I would have said, that's fantastic. And I would have thought that was really, truly meditating. But when I started reading Master Soho's book, I realized that's just beginner's mind. That's, you'd be commended for disciplining yourself to meditate like that. But really, true meditation is just letting your mind kind of float and focusing on your breath maybe a little bit, but just kind of see what enters your mind, how your body feels, getting more in tune with yourself. So that's kind of the philosophy as far as that book, and what I've really drawn from that is that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. I realized there's an infinity level of spirituality that you can achieve. And that book was really important for me. And it was interesting, because that's what gave the samurai their edge. There were great swordmen out there that they had to do battle with. But what made the samurai more elite was not their swords, not their technique, because the other swordmen had the same exact swords and technique, but it was that the philosophy that they had. In fact, what I understand, the essays that Master Soho wrote were privy just to the samurai for a period of time. Nobody else was able to see those. They were kind of private. It gave them that little extra edge. And that also encouraged me to realize that I really need to explore the depths of the mind, not just the depth of technique. Okay. So that book has been a big influence on me.
I'm adding that one to my list. That's cool.
All right. Right on.
How about, now this one you may not have an answer for. Some do, some don't. Do you have a favorite martial arts video game? Do you ever get into games?
No, I never did, man. You know, I like I said, I grew up in the 60s and and we didn't even have, we had three channels on our TV set, you know, never had a cell phone. You know the deal. You leave the house. Mom says, when the street lights come on, you better be home, you know, we'd be gone all day. So no, I never did. And I don't really like that stuff. You know, I teach underprivileged children in a couple schools locally. And a lot of times when I ask the kids, what did you do this weekend? And they'll say, oh, I got a high score on my video game. I'm like, that's what you did all weekend? Because a lot of people are really motivated. And I get it. That generation came up with that. But I'm kind of glad that I didn't, because I love, my video game is outdoors. You know, I'm part Cherokee. I found recently, I found a little bit about my heritage. So, and that makes sense to me, because I love animals. I love being outdoors. I have a tree farm that I'm very proud of. And I have 3 acres of land that I work all the time. So for me, being outdoors is my video game.
Okay, cool. All right. How about a favorite martial arts TV show?
Well, I certainly liked the Green Hornet. That was really cool. But I dug the Kung Fu series. You know, that was a real big one for me when I was younger. And then, again, I don't watch a lot of TV now, because I'm just too busy and I'm creating and doing things on my own. But I think that David Carradine did a great job with that. And I love the philosophy aspects. And, of course, the fight scenes were cool, too.
Yeah. You hear they're remaking that as a movie with Donnie Yen?
Really?
Yeah. They just announced it like a week or so ago.
Well, I expect you to be on top of those things, Brian. Well done. Yeah, no, I haven't heard that. That's great. I'll have to keep my eyes open for that.
I'm not always a fan of remakes, but I love Donnie Yen, so I will definitely watch it. It'll be good.
Yeah, no, he's great. That's awesome.
All right, how about a favorite martial arts movie?
Well, I hate to keep dipping into the same pool, but I think Enter the Dragon was probably one that really got me. And again, I love the beginning of that, when he was grappling with that student and then he had to break away for a lesson. He's in, follow my finger. And he slapped a kid on the head. And then emotional content. You know, I love those types of things. And then Fighting Without Fighting. That was a good one, you know.
Oh, the guy in the boat.
This fighting with, that was awesome. You know, and I read somewhere that Bruce Lee, you know, he obviously dug doing the movies, but he, unless I read this wrong or maybe made this up, but he said that he really liked doing the movies so he could get the philosophy out there to educate people on philosophy. And there was a lot of philosophy in all of his movies, which I really liked a lot. So
Yeah, I've heard too. So
yeah, cool. All right, good. But that movie was great.
Final question. Now, this doesn't have to be a martial arts movie. Any movie you've ever seen, favorite movie fight scene?
Oh, man. Oh, gee. You get me on this stuff because I really don't watch a whole lot of... well, I think, again, I love that Chuck Norris, Bruce Lee fight scene. What movie was that? Yeah, I always mix up the names of them, but not Enter the Dragon, Game of Death maybe, but yeah, in the Colosseum. That was really cool. And then when I read about how they had to set that up, I think they kind of snuck in there. Actually, they weren't supposed to use that. And that whole fight scene was really cool. So I think that was probably one of my favorites. And there's a lot of modern day ones. I saw some Jackie Chan stuff, which just knocked me out.
Yeah.
You know, no. but that probably the one that comes to mind would be that Bruce Lee versus Chuck Norris. That was really cool.
No, I agree. That one gets picked a lot. That seems to be a favorite one though. Like it's come on a few different names, but Way of the Dragon, I think, was the Chinese name of the movie. So
right there you go, yeah, Way of the Dragon. Yeah, cool.
Well, I know you got to get going, but before I let you go, anything that I maybe forgot to ask you about that you want to get out there quick, and I will put a link for your school and anything else you need me to once the episode comes out.
Oh, thank you. No, you know, I'm just grateful for this opportunity. It really inspires me, and I hope in some small way it might inspire some listeners. One thing that I think that has been very important for me is to be able to take the discipline and etiquette and you know, intestinal fortitude that I've taken from the martial arts and apply them to other aspects of my life. You know, I'm a professional drummer. I play proudly with John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band, which I know you interviewed Mike Antunes.
Yep.
Interesting story. I was a ookie for his first degree black belt test. I don't know if you mentioned that to you or not, but I was 16 years old and ookied for him. But, you know, those guys have been very good friends of mine, and I worked really hard for many years to become the drummer because they're a high-level band. But I know that the martial arts discipline gave me that focus and determination to pursue that. And I have, like I said, my property and my tree farm and my school. So I guess what I'm just trying to say is that when you study the physical aspects of it, but look deeply into the art. I'll leave you with a quote that I wrote many, many years ago. And it goes like this: what lies on the surface is for everyone to see, but the person who gets on their knees and digs in time will find the real treasures. And I wrote that probably 30 years ago. And I probably didn't even fully understand what it meant at the time. It just seemed to kind of flow together. But it really did kind of encapsulate where I was at that time and where I have gone to. So not being afraid to get on your hands and knees, which is a sign of humility, and digging, which is obviously a sign of hard work. But you will eventually find the real treasures. What they are is personal. It's not necessarily money or fame or fortune or a world championship. Ultimately, we have to fight those battles within ourselves and conquer ourselves and try to become a true master of ourselves. And so I think that that's what I would like to leave you with and your listening audience, is to try to make that connection, because it's there. It takes a lot of hard work. Humility is the starting aspect of it. You have to be humble and realize that, you know, you're good, but you could be better, and to be respectful and kind to people, try to help people when you can, because that karma comes right back to you. But that's all martial arts based, and that's what I've taken from the art, and I'm so proud of that, and I want to continue that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, my friend.
I like it, and I truly appreciate your time. This has been a wonderful experience. I love getting to know more about you, and I actually can't wait till the book comes out so I can learn even more, but I think the listeners are really going to like this.
Thank you so much. I have a great deal of respect for you. I know how time-consuming this can be. You edit all these episodes. You told me, how many have you done? A couple hundred now?
Yeah, 160 almost.
Man, well, I'm going to give you a big thank you from the martial arts community, because you're giving a lot of people who might not be on the big screen or in the magazines all the time an opportunity to express themselves and share their philosophy and their art. So thank you very much for what you do, brother. I'm grateful.
Like you mentioned earlier, everyone has a story, and I like giving people a chance to tell that story. So I do appreciate hearing yours.
It's very healthy and very healthy for our world. So thanks for what you're doing, man.
Thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist. We hope you'll join us every week for a brand new episode with a different martial artist telling their story. If you enjoy the show, be sure to leave us a review. Also, be sure to check out our website at everydaymartialartist.com. There you can find all of our episodes and contact us to suggest guests and ask questions. Again, thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist, and we'll see you next week.